Investment Committee. It'll come to order. It is Tuesday, February 20th at 3 p.m. And welcome all the members who are here on time, and welcome to the members who will be joining us shortly, I'm sure. The first thing we have on the agenda is from the Department of Administration. We're learning more about the Sustainable Building Guideline recommendations. So if Mr. Wasloski is here and Dr. Graves, please come and join us, and welcome to the committee, and proceed with your recommendation. And somebody is hybrid? Stephanie Simon. And who's
okay. Madam Chair, right. Members, for the record, Wayne Wasloski, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Administration. Thanks for the opportunity to present our recommendations from the report that the Center for Sustainable Building Research put together. And with me is Richard Graves, the director for the center. So he's going to walk through the presentation.
Welcome, Dr. Graves.
Great. Thank you, Chair Pappas and members of the committee. I have slides, but I think they're in your packet, so I could just walk through them and refer to the slides as I go. So my name is Richard Graves, and I am the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. CSBR developed updates, provides technical assistance, and works with project teams for the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines Program, also known as B3, for the Departments of Administration and Commerce. The program was created by the legislature in 2001 and has been updated over the years. Now I'm on the second slide. The B3 program involves a number of parts, from the guidelines that are used on capital construction projects for new, renovated, or combined buildings, the SB 2030 energy and carbon standard that is used for the requirements for B3. SB 2030 is also used as the energy carbon standard for a number of municipalities' green building ordinances, and the standard was used as a roadmap for future versions of the Commercial Energy Code in Minnesota that was passed last session. And finally, the B3 program also tracks energy usage, provides operations improvement processes, and conducts post-occupancy evaluations on existing buildings and completed projects. During its 20-plus year history, over 4,000 people have worked on B3 projects, from design teams to contractors to project owners of various sizes and types. 492 projects are enrolled in the B3 guidelines at various phases of design, construction, and occupancy. These projects are located across Minnesota and range from large stadiums and multifamily housing projects to park buildings, transit stations, and the historic Fort Snelling revitalization you can see a photograph of. Together, these buildings are estimated to save close to 1 million MMBTUs of annual energy savings. This is like eliminating the building and energy emissions from the city of Falcon Heights every year, and saves the state of Minnesota public building owners millions of operation dollars every year. And finally, over 10,500 public buildings are tracking their operational energy use through B3 benchmarking to help a variety of public and private sector building owners run their buildings more efficiently. In the last session, the legislature requested a report with recommendations for the program. CSBR worked with the Department of Administration to deliver the report on October 15th, 2023. The report made recommendations in the following areas: updating program goals and measuring performance, applicability of B3 for projects, different project types, reviewing compliance and giving waivers for program requirements, outreach and training for design teams and owners, administration of the program, and resources and support for the program going forward. The process that we used to get stakeholder input for the report involved sending out a survey to over 2,500 members of the B3 listserv that involves everybody involved in projects. We also did four focus groups with more than 62 people participating that involve design teams and contractors, state agencies and owners of B3 projects, advocacy groups, and then we had a fourth focus group that we brought everybody together just to have more opportunities for them to have discussions. In addition, we had additional meetings with stakeholders to address representation gaps in the survey process and focus groups and to increase participation. And those additional meetings involved having meetings with design teams, contractors and owners in greater Minnesota, small design teams that work on nonprofit projects, owners of nonprofit and municipal projects that might need to do B3 depending on the funding source, subcontractors, suppliers, trade associations, environmental groups, and green building organizations. So the findings, the specific findings and recommendations can be found in the report that's in your packet. But in summary, the existing statutes focus on the creation of the B3 program and have not been updated for the administration and management of the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines Program. Also, the statutes are complicated and confusing in the requirements for projects, which projects are required to use the B3 guidelines, depending upon if they're a new project, a renovated project, some combination, et cetera, et cetera. The statutes do not include education, training, compliance tracking, or giving waivers or scope determinations for projects, which is needed to just simply run a program with a wide variety of project types. In addition, some of the things we found through surveys and focus groups are, you know, many project owners do not understand their responsibilities for working on B3 projects and giving approvals for project teams to move projects forward. Funding has not been updated for inflation or changes in scope for the program over the years. And then finally, the B3 program provides many benefits for not only state construction, but across the broader construction and building industry in Minnesota. So, you know, summary of recommendations, and again, more specific findings and recommendations can be found in the report, are to update the statutes to have the Department of Administration oversee and administer the program. This will provide accountability, a process for determining waivers from the requirements and scope determinations. It'll also allow for compliance tracking and reporting to the department, but also back to the legislature on how the program is doing and what we're getting for project compliance. We're also recommending streamlining the B3 goals and application of those to projects. For example, we recommended in the report thinking about a minimum project size. We've done some additional work since the report was sent to you that we feel pretty confident that a 10,000 square foot minimum size would be a good recommendation, because that would, we have a lot of projects that are smaller than that, but it makes up a very small percentage of the overall square footage and environmental impact of programs in B3. We also feel that a common definition for new renovation and addition projects would help streamline and clarify which projects are required to meet the guidelines. We also feel that we could refine and simplify the B3 guidelines in some ways to have fewer requirements but still make the impact and meet the goals that the legislature is looking for. And then we feel that we can and should be reporting key performance indicators to revise revise goals from the legislature. We're currently reporting indicators with our scorecard, but we can align our scorecard with a revised set of goals. And then finally, you know, if education and training is part of the scope of the B3 program, what we found from the survey and focus groups that stakeholders are looking for online education and training by their project role, and that there's the need for new education and training for project owners and first-time participants in the program. And then finally, there's a need for updating the project tracking tool and resources to streamline design and review. So finally, We have, CSBR has been working with the Department of Administration to make very limited updates and process improvements that do not require additional funding and or legislative action. Those involve exploring the idea of updating program goals, measuring performance, and refining the guidelines like I just talked about previously, reviewing the impact of creating a minimum size for project applicability, and then developing standardized practices for reviewing project documentation to speed up approvals and review of projects. And then finally, looking at statute changes and additional funding required to address the recommendations found in the report. So thank you, Chair, and we're here to answer questions.
So Dr. Graves and Assistant Commissioner, there isn't legislation yet, but is there, is the department or is your organization, the research center, are you working on legislation or what's the process that's been going on since the report and continuing? Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, we certainly wanted to get the report in front of the legislature and have that conversation. We did have extensive conversations last session, particularly over in the House on some potential legislation. We think from the work that was done to survey stakeholders and get additional feedback, there's some modifications that would be needed to that language, but there is essentially some language that could be ready to go to implement that the recommendations in the report. It obviously requires a discussion around funding as well.
Well, we know funding is a problem this year, but if there's recommendations that we could proceed with little or limited funding, I think we want to at least keep the ball rolling so that we can address some of these issues that Dr. Graves found out with in the report. Any questions, Senator Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question, when we're thinking about B3, do we have any estimates for how much these requirements add to the total project cost of different capital projects on which it's applied to?
Dr. Graves.
Thank you, Senator. We try to track the additional capital construction cost and time required on B3 projects and have done some studies trying to track that. One of the challenges is the wide variety of project sizes and project team expertise with the requirements. Historically, when we did a study about 5 years ago, we found the increased capital construction cost was like 1-3% for projects at that time. But that's one of the things that we talk about in the report that we would like to keep to make cost be one of the metrics that we're tracking so that we can do a more thorough study of cost-benefit analysis of increased capital costs, but what are the returns?
Any other questions? Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Senator Rasmussen asked the first part of the question I was going to ask, and I was going to ask the second part as well, which was, do we also keep track of, so a lot of these have to do with energy conservation, efficiency, healthy buildings, et cetera. And I was wondering if we have any data that shows the operational benefit, either direct benefit, in terms of better, more efficient use of energy and or the benefit to organizations having better lighting, healthier workers, better air, et cetera. Some of the both direct benefit and or externalities that we might be able to track. Don't know if you do that, just wondering. Thanks.
Dr. Graves.
Yes, Senator. We have a scorecard for every project, so you can look at the project level of what the savings are for energy, water usage, reduced construction waste, et cetera, We roll all those up with quarterly reports to the department on total energy savings, total carbon savings. In addition, the post-occupancy evaluations that I mentioned, we do somewhere between 2 and 8 post-occupancy evaluations every year where we survey building occupants for improvements to their well-being of the projects for things like lighting, better indoor air quality, and other issues in those projects. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, creating a more systematic way to kind of report up to those metrics and scoop the whole program together would, I think, would have a lot of benefits to the state project teams and others. So,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Graves, I was interested in a little bit more on your comments regarding streamlining the B3 goals and application. And the first part was pretty clear. Project minimum size looks like 10,000 square feet is pretty clear. I'm curious, do you have any similar type clarity regarding the common definition for new renovations or additions?
Dr. Graves.
We haven't, Senator, we haven't worked through the exact kind of definition with the department on exactly how to streamline that common definition for new buildings, renovations, and additions, other than it ought to be the same requirement. But we haven't worked through the specific specific language. I think we drafted something when we started to develop a bill, but we haven't finalized that.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Graves. So that would be interesting to get, because as Senator Pappas said, money is going to be tight, but there are things that can be done regarding, like, changing the minimum size required, or changing that to not required, I guess, or required over 10,000 square feet. So those very simple clarity things, I think, would be important, like changing the minimum size or clarifying that, and then the new definition about what those new or renovation or additions are, what are the difference between them. I think that would be helpful. And the third, the last thing I would say would be really helpful is to refine and simplify the B3 guidelines. Those are great things that would help us moving forward, and they should not cost anything, but they would make it so that going forward, things would be probably more efficient, get better outcomes, maybe with less frustration. So I would be interested in seeing if you have put together clarity on any of those other issues.
Dr. Graves.
So in terms of the project minimum size and the kind of reduced set of key performance indicators, we floated those in front of the focus groups to get kind of a general feeling and agreement on those. So that, I agree, is could be kind of low cost, no cost, with significant process improvements. A more comprehensive kind of reduction of the total number of guidelines, fortunately or unfortunately, requires the remaking of project tracking tools, documentation, education, training. So that would require kind of short-term funding to do that work, redo those tools, to then kind of get the return on streamlining down the road. So what we're doing right now is trying to scope that out and figure out how much it would take to do that and what the process would entail.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might just, I'll be very careful. My question, it's just that aren't some of those things just part of continual improvement that would be done? I mean, I guess I'm just a little at loss why additional funding would be needed to update documents and that type of thing. Why can that not be just part of the process that, you know, all agencies, departments, projects take on? It's just part of, you know, continual improvement. So I must be missing something as to why there needs to be an additional cost to have those type of document simplifications and improvements.
Looks like Assistant Commissioner Wozlowski is going to take that.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it's certainly a reasonable and fair question. I think as Mr. Graves mentioned, This B3 hasn't had any funding increase since its inception in 2005, so it's been level funding, and obviously inflation is certainly taken a bite out of the resources that are available. So I think that is certainly one thing, but there is, you know, a fair amount of work that's going to be involved in reformatting the tools that are made available, along with some additional education that would be needed. We still put this, you know, there's things that can be done that we think are on the lower cost range we can come forward with, but if to do a wholesale rework of the guidelines, you know, this is it's a workflow tool, so it's going to take some resources to redo that tool.
Thank you. And then one last comment.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the budget is currently now on auto inflation, so the next budget will have inflationary increases in it automatically. So I would hope that some of these things could be taken care of just as part of the regular budgeting going forward. Thank you.
We have a question from our Senate counsel who is online with us on the report on page 12. Dr. Graves, if you could just speak a little bit about this and kind of explain how the scorecard works.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So page 12 shows an example project scorecard, and so the scorecard has seven different indicators: energy, carbon, water, indoor water use, outdoor water use, and basically the way it works is the project gets a target for what the goal is. So let's take, for example, energy use, which is the top indicator on the scorecard. A project, based upon its size and usage, gets a target that the project team is trying to target when they design the project. In this case, the design is using 46 kbtus per square foot per year, which is in the green zone, which means it's meeting its requirements. If it were in the yellow into the red zone, it's above its requirements. And so that's basically how it works all the way down through here for the various indicators. So
it's doing, if it's above its indicators, it would be in the red zone? No,
yeah,
that's,
it would. And so this will.
You mean it's using too much energy?
It's using too much energy.
I got it. So that's the negative part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Or it's using too much water, or it's you know, it has too much construction waste, those kinds of things.
So the outdoor environment, water outdoor is really doing very well, the best.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The indoor environment is doing very well.
Exactly.
Yeah, got it. But everything is within the green zone.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about language that I had proposed last year, having to do with building in some resiliency aspects into the guidelines. A, did that actually pass into law? I lost track of it. B, are we working on that? Is that something that's going to happen or has happened?
Yep.
Thanks.
This Dr. Graves? Okay, Dr. Graves.
Madam Chair, Senator DeVille. Yes, it did pass in the last session, and we're going ahead with integrating resilience across the guidelines. In particular, what we've been working on in the last 6 months is working on future climate files and how they can be used to meet the energy guidelines. We are also working on scoping out the same kind of forward climate projections for site and water design, and how that could include a new data set for civil engineers, landscape architects, and also new design processes to integrate that in. So that's in process.
Would you just explain to us, either Assistant Commissioner or Dr. Graves, what is the relationship between the Department of Administration and the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the U of M? How is it a partnership? What is it?
Yep.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, so we contract with the university and Center for Sustainable building research through a joint powers agreement. And this is really going back from the inception of the program itself. Department of Commerce has also been involved. The funding flows through Department of Commerce. We have a interagency agreement with Commerce to then facilitates us contracting with the Center for Sustainable Building Research. And then we're in very regular communication on a variety of topics on where there's any issues coming up on projects. Department of Administration doesn't get any general fund dollars for this program, so we don't have any specific staff that are assigned to this. Our team with Real Estate and Construction Services helps coordinate the work for the department.
Anything you want to add, Dr. Graves? Like, do you have other contracts that you have at the center?
Yes.
Are you supported by the U of M? Blah, blah, blah.
Senator Pappas, the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the university is what's considered a soft-funded center, so all of our funding comes from grants and contracts. We don't get any direct funding from the university. So most of our work are work like this for B3 or SB 2030, or we work with municipalities, for example, like I mentioned, helping them advise on green building ordinances. We do federal research for the Department of Energy and other groups like that, but it's really kind of a mix of grants and contracts with a variety of groups.
So is it your plan, Assistant Commissioner, that you will have some legislation for us to consider yet this session?
Madam Chair, yes. We'll be coming back with some recommendations on legislation.
I'm sorry, recommendations on legislation or actual legislative language?
Legislative language, and then we'll also, it would likely be a variety of, a menu of options. If there's additional funding available, then we can add in things. If there's no funding available, here's what it would look like.
Okay, great. Well, keep us in the loop on your work. Thank you. And Senator Jasinski, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Grace. So I'm familiar with a building, and it was a MnDOT building, and they went through the sustainable building guidelines, and I think at the end of the building they did a thermal imaging of the building to make sure it was standard, efficient, things like those. And I guess I just look at, is there an ROI or return on investment that we're looking at? Because in this instance, they had the whole building thermal energy, or they did a photo of it and saw where the leakages were. And one example was a fire main, where the fire main comes into the building. So when a fire truck shows up, they can hook up to that. And it showed a small little, you know, escape of a probably energy coming out there. But it was right next to a 14-foot overhead door that opens probably 30 to 45 times a day. And we're looking at the heat that's escaping. You know, one little small item like that next to a door that's opening, you know, constantly all day. So my question is, there's a return on investment for what we're spending on making sure these buildings are this tight and sustainable and those versus what it costs to do that. Because I'm assuming the thermal energy report was not cheap to have it done. And again, you're pointing out defects of a small little thing next to an overhead door that's opening, like I said, 45 times a day, I'm sure. So do we look at that at all? Just, you know, because we always talk about inflation. And I always sometimes look at inflation as done by regulation, because we're putting all more of these more and more requirements on these buildings like this. So we're increasing the cost of them ourselves, and then we always refer to it as inflation. Well, it's regulation, because we're adding more things that are costing, making buildings cost more. So do we look at a return on investment for all these extra costs we're making? Is there a payback over time that we're receiving benefit for these added inflation or regulation, whatever you want to call it?
I can take that.
Yeah, go ahead, Don. Yeah, you go first.
Okay.
Dr. Green.
Senator Pappas, and Senator, I appreciate the question. So for the energy requirements, there's actually in statute that we need to look at return on investment based upon utility standards, which for us translates into a 12-year payback. So if we're going to spend additional money for insulation or, you know, I'm assuming this is a fire station, so a big thing in fire stations for efficiency is having a insulated garage door that can open and close quickly so you're not wasting that heat. So all those measures, you would look at what's their additional cost, and then you'd do an energy model to see if that additional cost is going to pay back within 12 years. So that's the standard, and it's very common for projects to come up with ideas, think about doing it, but you don't do it because it's not gonna meet that kind of ROI test. And then on the back end, once the design's completed, we really review the project not for kind of individual issues, but kind of overall. Much like I showed in that scorecard, where the targets of 46 energy usage for the whole building, we then track operations to see is the whole building kind of operating within that target, factoring in all the various things that are going to go on between heat loss from a door opening and closing in a fire station and other losses. So it's more holistic, trying to come up with the right decisions that will pay back and not kind of throw money into things that may not have benefits for that building owner.
Okay, thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Next, I'd like to invite Evelyn Weiner to come forward with the Infrastructure Resilience Task Force. And I understand our Senator Jasinski was on this task force. Do you have any comments you'd like to make about the experience? Was it fun? As fun as the bonding tours?
I wouldn't say it was as fun as bonding tours, but...
Right answer.
It was a learning experience. There was a lot of time spent, I guess, is the one thing that I would comment, and whether we're going to see the benefits of all that time spent would be my question, but there was just a lot of time spent, so I hope some benefits will come out of it, because again, we met, I think, 7 or 8 meetings during the summer, and some of them were very lengthy, and mm-hmm. so I just hope that the benefits of the committee or of the group will have some benefits. So
great. Thank you. Sure. And welcome, is it Weiner?
Yes.
All right, welcome, Ms. Weiner, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Evelyn Weiner. I was the research analyst from the Legislative Coordinating Commission assigned to the Infrastructure Resilience Advisory Task Force. I also have a slideshow presentation that you should have in your packets. I'm just going to run through the task force and then the recommendations that came out of it. So the task force was established to evaluate issues related to coordination, sustainability, resiliency, and federal funding on state, local, and private infrastructure in the state. It was designed to develop objectives and strategies to provide for effective and efficient management of state, local, and private infrastructure, enhance sustainability and resiliency of infrastructure throughout the state, respond to and mitigate the effects of adverse weather events across the state, including natural disasters, droughts, and floods, and provide for equitable treatment in areas of persistent poverty and historically disadvantaged communities. It also served to identify approaches to enhance infrastructure coordination across jurisdictions, agencies, state and local government, and public and private sectors, including in planning, design, engineering, construction, maintenance, and operations. It was to identify methods to maximize federal formula and discretionary funds provided to recipients in the state for infrastructure purposes, and finally, to evaluate options for organizational design of state agencies to meet the purposes above, including consideration of options for establishment of a board, council, office, or other agency, models in other states, and to develop findings and recommendations related to the duties specified in this subdivision. The next slide details the membership of the task force. So as you'll see, it was chaired by Representative Aaron Cagle, and the vice chair was Representative Don Gilman. We also had Senator Jim Carlson and Senator John Jasinski on.
I don't think you need to go over
sure.
the membership. We can look at it.
No problem.
All right, thanks.
The next slide has the 8 meetings that took place over the time that we had together. In the first meeting, chairs were elected. Second meeting, we heard testimony from the Michigan Infrastructure Council and the Climate Action Framework. The third meeting was discussion-based. The fourth meeting, we heard testimony from the University of Minnesota's Empowering Small Communities Project. In the fifth meeting, members discussed the mission statement. The sixth meeting, the mission statement and board structure were finalized. The seventh meeting was discussion-based again. And then the final meeting, the report was finalized and approved. So the next 2 slides go over the Michigan Infrastructure Council. This was the base that the members used to design the board. The Michigan Infrastructure Council is comprised of 9 voting members who are representative of one or more of the following asset management experts in the public and private sectors, financial and procurement experts from the public or private sector, and experts in regional asset management. It also is comprised of 9 non-voting members, which represent state agencies, including the Water Asset Management Council, the Transportation Asset Management Council, and the Michigan Public Service Commission. The mission and goals of the Michigan Infrastructure Council were to define a vision for Michigan's infrastructure that provides the foundation for public and environmental health, economic prosperity, and quality of life. The 5 tenets that they used were to collaborate, coordinate, educate, invest, and prioritize. So finally, the recommendations that came out of the task force is a board that would be charged with defining and maintaining a vision for the future of Minnesota's infrastructure that provides for proper management, coordination, and investment. The board would work in a non-regulatory capacity and in tandem with stakeholders to identify and promote best practices that will preserve and extend the longevity of Minnesota's public and privately owned infrastructure. The board would consist of 15 non-voting members that are experts in an aspect of infrastructure and 11 voting members. And then the duties of the board would include, but were not limited to, electing a chair, hiring an executive director, identifying approaches to enhance and expedite infrastructure coordination across jurisdictions, agencies, state and local government, and public and private sectors. Areas of coordination could include planning, design, engineering, construction, maintenance, and operations. Other duties of the board would include developing an educational program on asset management and writing an annual report to the legislature. And I'm happy to answer any questions on that.
And I think I've seen the legislation on this. So, I mean, it will come before us as a bill potentially to see if it's something that we want to consider. I don't really know too much about it since it was really kind of a House initiative, but I believe we have the draft, don't we? For this? Yeah, I think we do. Any questions at all for Ms. Weiner? All right. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And we all have the final report. Oh, next I want to welcome Mr. Micah Intermill, who is the Enterprise Director, Federal Funds Implementation with MMB. We're very excited that you were hired to kind of help us get more federal money, since we know we have such a huge interest and demand, both from our state agencies who need asset preservation, as well as our local governments and our local communities. So looking forward to your presentation, Mr. Intermill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and candidly, I'm glad I was hired too. So great to be here. Good afternoon, Chair Pappas, Vice Chair Fah, Lead Housley, and members of the committee. My name is Micah Intermill. I am the state's Enterprise Director for Federal Funds Implementation, housed at Minnesota Management and Budget. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today and provide an update with respect to how the state is responding to the massive opportunity represented in the 3 recently enacted federal investment bills, the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS Act. This presentation is the beginning of a conversation requested by the chair to help provide the committee context on the volume of infrastructure investments taking part across the state, which are driven primarily by federal funds. My goal today is to provide education and develop a baseline consensus understanding of the state's approach. Should it interest the committee to go deeper into particular funding areas, I'd be happy to come back and present along with experts from other agencies on how these federal funds are being used to support specific needs across the state. So I believe you have the slides in your packet as well. So just moving to that first slide, I'll start by giving you a high-level introduction to the Federal Funds Implementation Unit, which is a new team created in the 2023 legislative session. I'll then provide an overview of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, and the CHIPS and Science Act, or CHIPS. Third, we'll get a brief preview of Minnesota's projected IIJA awards to date, and this will be at a very high level, but we'll preview the any deeper conversation you'd like to have. And finally, I'll share a first look at Minnesota's IIJA and IRA Opportunity Tracker, which is a new tool developed by my team and published literally just days ago. So moving to the next slide, it's important to recognize the historical context around these massive generational investments that the federal government is making. As you see at the left of the slide, the story arguably began in November of 2021 with the passage of the IIJA. The IRA and CHIPS Act followed suit in the summer of 2022, and the three bills became the basis for a great many activities across the state enterprise as agencies set to work almost immediately to seek and bring home available federal resources just as they continue to today. As you'll recall, discussions were had in this committee and others in the 2022 legislative session, providing information to the extent it was known on available programs and formula allocations, as well as estimated state matching needs. And in 2023, in particular, the legislature appropriated many of the matching dollars necessary and provided enterprise-level coordination support through the funding of me and my office, as mentioned, as well as other positions across the state enterprise. I think we're trying to make sure that this technology works, and we may be slightly striking out. Apologies for that. There we go. We're home. Thank you very much, Ms. Carlson. So that brings us to a fuller discussion of that federal funds implementation team. Because this is a new function, it feels important to help you understand who we are and what we're here to do and how we're approaching our work. So as mentioned, I have the pleasure of serving the state as its enterprise director for federal funds implementation. I come to this role having spent roughly the past 20 years in various roles in and around government, both in direct public service at the federal, state, and local level, as well as in the private sector in roles providing support and assistance to professional staff and policymakers alike. Having served in state roles previously, I returned in this capacity last November, drawn by both the challenge and opportunity of starting a team from scratch, as well as just the multi-generational impact that the work we facilitate will have. And truly, as I sit here today, I'm more excited about the opportunities ahead for Minnesota than I was the day that I returned to the Capitol campus. I'm currently joined on the team by two others, one individual who serves as a state agency coordinator working with and between state agencies and outside entities to bring alignment to our work, and another who serves as our data analyst and communications specialist, working together just the vast and varied amounts of data related to the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS Act, so that not only can we inform Minnesotans about the opportunities, but better focus our work internally to maximize our efforts as an enterprise. We've also posted and will soon be interviewing for an external relations coordinator who will be responsible for interacting primarily with non-state entities. So think tribal nations, local governments, nonprofit organizations, schools, and others to ensure that they're aware and taking advantage of these federal opportunities as well. And the four of us really are here to work across state agencies to ensure successful alignment and implementation of these federal investment bills. I've included a graphic at the right of this slide that helps illustrate how we're doing that work. So with a small team and a large charge, we're working to first find gaps in implementation efforts, either within agencies or between outside eligible entities. Once we find those gaps, we're working to fill them either in direct service roles or by connecting individual experts who may be better positioned to solve for problems amongst each other. And finally, and perhaps more importantly, the biggest gear that you see in that graphic, we're here to tell success stories so that individuals and organizations can not only see themselves in the opportunities available, but also understand how to access those opportunities should they be fit. Finally, we approach the work with the ultimate goal of supporting Minnesota's public infrastructure needs and climate goals by maximizing all available opportunities in all sectors, which is to say we're focusing on Minnesota broadly. So think a lowercase m as opposed to a capital M. So at the end of the day, when the story is written on the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS Act, our state is at the top of the list in terms, yes, of the dollars received, but more importantly, the good work that's funded by these investments. Really appreciate the opportunity to introduce who we are and how we're approaching the work, but I'll now turn the attention to the meat of the investments themselves with an overview of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS Act. These three pieces of legislation, which are collectively known as the investment bills, are massive and bring with them a generational opportunity for Minnesota. Beyond their sheer size, it's important to note they work together in complementary ways to achieve various policy goals. As I mentioned earlier, the first bill to pass was the IIJA. This bill contains $1.2 trillion with a focus on traditional infrastructure. So think roads, bridges, pipes, ports, and so on, as well as transitioning our nation's energy systems to cleaner and renewable energy sources. The IRA overlaps significantly with the IIJA in the area of energy transition and also introduces funding opportunities specifically available to support decarbonization and other climate resilience and pollution reduction work. The CHIPS Act, while still providing significant sum of resources, is the smallest of the three bills, and its focus is much narrower. It aims to increase American competitiveness by investing deeply in the development of the manufacturing sectors of tomorrow. I've included dollar amounts on the slide to reinforce the size of the opportunities that lie ahead for Minnesota. As I mentioned a few times already, these are truly generational investments. And as you know, through your work on this committee, decisions made about when, where, and how much concrete to pour or steel to set are ones that our children and grandchildren will experience in their daily lives. And this is true whenever infrastructure investments are being made. What's unique about IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS is their size. It can be difficult to immediately understand that a billion and a trillion are not just the next markers past a million. So for context, a million seconds is about 12 days. A billion seconds is half a lifetime or a bit under 32 years. A trillion seconds is more than all of recorded history at a bit under 32,000 years. The point is, there's a lot of opportunity in these federal investments, and Minnesota is well positioned to take every advantage of them that we can. Before we turn back to the dollars and cents, I wanted to spend a moment touching on the differences between the investment bills and the major federal spending bills that immediately preceded them, those being the CARES Act and ARPA, also known as the Rescue Plan or Recovery Funds. The nature, goals, and funding mechanisms of each set of legislation is fundamentally different, and the differences are important when considering how decisions are made about dollars being spent. CARES and ARPA represented an emergency response to the public health pandemic and the public financial crisis it triggered. The primary goal was to get dollars out quickly to drive that response, so the mechanism used to distribute dollars was large block grant programs with broad spending authority. Awards were made to states and local governments, and the governing bodies of each unit was responsible for deciding how to use dollars after they had been received. IRA, IIJA, and CHIPS are steering intentionally directed investments with a goal of effectuating the policy objectives just discussed. The mechanisms used then are to fund individual projects through specific programs. This means that the decision of how to use dollars is being made when applications are going in, not when dollars are received. As the committee is considering its work of developing an infrastructure package and contemplating how federal investment opportunities may support the state's dollars, this slide represents important distinction and difference of today's reality from what we experienced under prior federal funds. To the point of intentionally directed investments, this slide represents where and how the federal government is focusing its dollars under the IIJA. The vast majority, just over three of every $4 of IIJA funding, is for transportation projects. Over half of the funds represent a reauthorization of the FAST Act and support its emphasis on federal surface transportation infrastructure and safety. These dollars are accompanied by additional transportation programming dollars in the areas of roads and bridges, rail, transit, airports and ports, and transportation safety. The IIJA also provides significant funding in traditional infrastructure areas of broadband and water infrastructure, as well as monies to support our environment through the stewardship of public lands. Finally, as mentioned, the legislation carries a secondary emphasis on climate and clean energy, with 10 cents of every dollar going to support investments in energy and the power grid, electric vehicle infrastructure, and climate resilience and adaptation. This is all very good news, as Minnesota has massive needs in these areas in all corners of the state. However, in general, these monies are not programmed to support the asset preservation needs or new construction of public buildings, which of course represents a major need in communities across Minnesota and is an emphasis of this committee.
I just met Mr. Intermill. So the FAST Act reauthorization, that's kind of an existing funding that we have for transportation projects, basically. So it's just kind of continuing what was already there.
Madam Chair,
that's the right half of the of the chart, and then the rest of it is new funding?
That's a good question, and actually the next slide speaks directly to that.
Okay, I'll hold my comments.
Not at all. Thank you. You're well on track for the presentation. To that, there are two other important points to consider when thinking about the grants. So first, roughly three-quarters of the grant funding made available is allocated based on those formula calculations. These formulas are based on different factors depending on which funding area we're looking at, but the how much story on those funds has been written. The remaining quarter of IIJA grant funds are being dispersed through competitive award processes. Minnesota is being aggressive in pursuing these competitive opportunities, and I'll share more on those successes in a few slides. But to the chair's comment, the second artifact of the IIJA grant ecosystem to keep in mind is 75% of grant funds have been made available through reauthorization of previous programs. So both the FAST Act, as you saw on the previous slide, as well as other programs. Once planning for an infrastructure project begins, it's often years before ground is broken on a facility, road, or bridge. And it's in having faith in the reauthorization process that allowed us to have shovel-ready projects that took advantage of IIJA funding early on. The remaining quarter of grant opportunities made available through new programs represent work that is pushing boundaries, either by equipping more shovel-ready projects than otherwise would have been funded, or providing funding for new areas such as the National Electric Vehicle Charging Network. Both segments of that pie, while unequal in size, are equally important to modernizing infrastructure in our state. So I'll turn back to the IIJA results to date in a moment, but I did want to touch briefly on federal funds under IRA and CHIPS. So the graphic at the left of the slide represents funding mechanisms contained within the IRA. So whereas most funding opportunities available under the IIJA are executed through grant agreements, the IRA is more complex and nuanced. The IRA contains three key mechanisms to distribute funds: grants, loans, and tax credits. Grant programs are capped at $110 billion. Loan programs are capped at approximately $500 billion. The third set of funds, clean energy tax credits, are uncapped, meaning there's as much money available as there is demand to use them. Estimates of the value of those credits ranging from $700 billion to $1.2 trillion. These credits are bigger than previous clean energy tax credits on a project-by-project basis. They're broader than previous programs, and for the first time, importantly for us, they are available as direct payments to non-taxable entities, including states like Minnesota, as well as local governments, tribal nations, nonprofits, schools, and others. And they're intended to immediately drive down the cost of switching from traditional fuel sources to renewable ones. The only catch with the credits is that they come after a project has been put into service, as opposed to a grant, which would be available to spend at the outset of a project. That's where the guaranteed loans come to provide a means for bridge and gap financing of projects at low costs. Final details of the tax credit program are still being worked out, and non-taxed entities of all stripes, including the state, are working together to inform the federal government on how best to finalize them. Turning back to those grants for a moment, like the IIJA, the grants available under the IRA represent a whole-of-government approach, as they come from several different agencies representing various policy objectives with emphasis on the clean energy transition, conservation, climate resilience, and pollution reduction efforts. Notably, though, in a meeting late last year, the Department of Energy noted 70% of IRA grant opportunities were either decided or in the process of being awarded. So while we continue to aggressively pursue opportunities like the Climate Pollution Reduction Grants or Solar for All program, among others, tax credits and loans truly remain the largest opportunity to bring federal funds back to Minnesota under the IRA. That then brings us to the CHIPS Act, which, as the graphic suggests, brings a three-pronged approach focused on driving economic security, national security, and future scientific innovation. Like the IRA, this legislation utilizes a mix of funding approaches, including manufacturing incentives, workforce development funds, tax credits for development and equipping of manufacturing facilities, and future authorizations of additional research and development funds. In the interest of time and turning back to the IIJA, we'll move to a summary of projected funding for Minnesota to date, and this will be a high-level review of where we're seeing the money flow. I've also got a summary of various projects funded through the IIJA, which we can either go through quickly or in a little bit of detail. This chart and the associated graphic represent the projected funding picture for Minnesota under the IIJA. These figures are informed by information obtained on February 6th from an organization known as Federal Funds Information for States, or FFIS, and includes both the announced competitive awards as well as calculated formula allocations. MMB and other states rely on FFIS to provide a comprehensive database of these projected funds so that we can see and understand how our experience relates to others. This service is invaluable, but it also comes with a caveat. Because of the complexities of delivering capital programming over multiple years, some programs do not fully distribute the calculated formula amounts, meaning the dollars that we ultimately receive will be fewer than the amounts shown on this slide. And this is most prevalent in the transportation space. As a result, my colleagues at MnDOT manage to a different number than shown here so that they can ensure that they don't fall short of funds needed to complete a given project. Other areas, such as water, have their own operational differences from the nationally reported state-specific numbers, so you may hear differences in that area when speaking with the PFA as well. Caveats aside, when MMB first came to this committee 2 years ago to talk about the IIJA, all that was known was that Minnesota was set to receive a calculated formula allocation of $7.4 billion. Today, I'm extremely happy to report that while that number has not changed, it's joined by roughly $2.3 billion of competitive awards that would not have come but for the hard and high quality of work performed across agencies in all corners of the enterprise. As we sit here today, Minnesota has claimed $9.7 billion of IIJA monies. The fact that Minnesota's mix of formula and competitive grant funding sits very near the 76-24 split shared on a previous slide should not be taken for granted. To the contrary, it's a testament to the fact that agencies have been doing the work they need to do to make sure Minnesota is not left behind. And if my team and I have done our jobs, we'll only see the share of competitive awards grow in the coming months and years. So, Madam Chair, the next two slides contain information on just selected highlights of projects and funding under the IIJA. I would be happy to go into a little bit of detail on these or let the committee just simply review and digest, depending on your preference for how we use our time.
It looks like you're doing selected highlights. I was just going to suggest you do selected highlights. But I really would like to have a comprehensive list.
Sure.
But this is fine for today.
Absolutely. So we'll leave the next two slides as they are and certainly be happy to provide you with that fuller list of funding under the IIJA.
And the amount of dollars would be helpful, too.
Yep, absolutely. So the last thing I did want to touch on briefly is the just released IIJA opportunity tracker. So just turning to that last slide then, when I started this role in November, I met with various stakeholder groups and individuals, and in general, they said two things. First, it's hard to get eligible entities, whether local units of government, tribal nations, or others, to understand the opportunity ahead of them because of the federal funds fatigue in the wake of ARPA and CARES, and because there's not a simple, easy clearinghouse of available opportunities. The second thing that I consistently heard was that the state of Michigan had a really good federal funds tracker. I couldn't be prouder of my team as they worked tirelessly over the past month to ensure that Minnesota would have an opportunity tracker of its own to help residents, businesses, and local governments and our partner tribal nations quickly and easily digest the current and upcoming IIJA opportunities. Folks can use this tracker to search by category, fiscal year, and soon entity type to learn more about the programs and funds available. I encourage you all to navigate to the URL shown on the slide and share it widely with your staff, your constituents, and anyone else interested in finding out how Minnesotans can take advantage of the historic opportunities under the IIJA. And the last point I'll make on the tracker is that what you see when you navigate to that site is a first iteration or V1. We'll plan to continue to enhance the quality of the information and usability of the tool, and we also have plans to include data and information on awarded funds in the coming weeks as well, so please stay tuned to that.
Mr. Intermill, because of the volume of requests that we've had, we typically ask local governments to do their best to provide 50% match. Are there requirements like that from the IIJA in general, or does it vary from category to category?
Yeah, absolutely, Madam Chair. It does vary from category to category. There are some funds that are available that require zero match. There are others that require 10, 20, 50% match. So it is a bit across the board program by program.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Intermill. So I see we have the tracker and things like that, but are you and your staff out actively talking with cities and counties and institutions like that to educate them what's available, how they get in, all those things, rather than just having a tracker? I get that's good, but it's always nice to have that sales pitch out there to educate them on how to get more funds, how to work through the system, how to make it easier for them, because I know some of the larger cities have staff that do that, but if you look at some of our smaller cities, especially below 5,000, they don't have the staff to understand all this. So tell me a little bit about how you plan on getting out to our smaller cities, townships, and those people to educate them on how they can get more money leveraged so they can use that.
Unfortunately, Mr. Intermill was hired after we'd completed most of our bonding tours, but I did invite him to join us, and I think you did join us for a couple tours that were local, but go ahead and
absolutely
answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. It's a great question and an important point. So when I did come on to into the role, I was able to meet with representatives from the League and the Association of Counties, as well as the Minnesota Townships, and sort of began to build that relationship around being able to educate on a broad scale. Right now, we only have two out of three staff in addition to me hired, but as I had mentioned, that fourth position that we're bringing on is an external relations coordinator. So their role truly will be to interact with local units of government, nonprofits, the K-12 and higher education system to ensure that they are tracking, for lack of a better term, what all of these opportunities are, and particularly some of the complexities around the tax credits. I leaned into that a little bit in my prepared remarks intentionally because, as I had said, not only are those uncapped, they're also non-competitive, meaning if you have a project that is eligible, you will get funds, and that will help buy down the cost of those energy improvements. And that's something that non-taxed entities in particular, they've never filled out a tax return, so this is something that they need education and coaching on. So we, along with the Department of Commerce and others, are engaged in those conversations regularly, meeting with various groups, but certainly, to your point, there are a lot of local governments of varying sizes, and so absolutely also working in partnership with the large interest organizations that support those entities as well.
Mentioned tax credits. Typically, you think of tax credits as something a business can use or an individual. You know, how does that apply here to government?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is a great question. And so, this is the first time this has ever been available to governments. So the it's a concept called direct pay or elective pay, where essentially the government. The local government, the state government, a school will put a project into service and then receive, in essence, a rebate from the federal government equal to what a tax credit would have been had they been a private entity.
Is this also available to nonprofits then as well? And how does that differ from, we hear a lot about the new market tax credits. Do you know if there's a difference there?
So, Madam Chair, I think I'm hesitant to go deeply into differences, but I think all of these things are built to work together, again, to drive down the cost of transition to renewable sources.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I had some questions, too, on the tax credits. And you answered part of that question regarding the direct pay. And in a sense, we would say that's kind of like having a refundable tax credit, basically, only it's refundable from the federal government. The other question, and if that's how that works, then I was going to say, were they assignable or transferable, which would actually make them even more valuable if they were assignable or transferable tax credits. And it would also bring in private funds to help in these instances. Are these tax credits assignable or transferable?
Mr. Intermill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. The direct pay are not. So the private sector use of these tax credits are transferable. The previously untaxed population, those are not transferable.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
And so thank you for that clarification. And then I also want to follow up on the chairs. So how would nonprofits participate then? Would that be through assignable and transferable tax credits, or would that be the direct pay? So talk to me a little bit about the nonprofits.
Mr. Intermill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, a nonprofit would apply just the same as the state will, which is to register a project with the IRS, put that project into service, and then once the project is in service, come back to the IRS for the direct payment at the time that they would typically file, were they a taxable entity.
And then, Madam Chair, last question.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So that's very interesting. And then I just want to make sure I understand that there is no cap on that direct pay then.
Madam Chair and Senator, that is correct. There is no cap. And that's why on the slide you saw there are estimates of how much money ultimately will be spent through the tax credits. Low-end estimates currently sit at $700 billion. High-end estimates currently sit at $1.2 trillion, depending on which group you're listening to in Washington, D.C. or New York City.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I guess that's what you can do when you don't have to have a balanced budget. You don't have to have a cap.
When you print
on
money.
Those type of things. Yeah, when you can print money, that's maybe
it does appear
works.
To be the limit, though. This is part of the Inflation Reduction Act. So it has to be a project defined as an energy transition or climate. Can you expand on that a little bit? What type of projects might those be?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. So projects that we're talking about really are renewable energy projects. So think solar projects, either on a facility or a field, you know, wind projects, also geothermal heat pumps and things of that nature. I think there are components that it's a complex program in that there are base credits available and then bonus credits that bonus credits may be available depending on the particular geography that the project exists in, as well as American-made materials and other things like that.
So those of you who were on the Northwest Tour, I think most of us were on the Northwest Tour, we were up in Crookston campus at the U of M, and they had their coal-fired furnace, which is needs to be replaced. And they were planning to replace it with a coal-fired furnace. And I said, no, you can't do that. That's a 30-year investment. Why aren't you doing something else? And they said they looked at geothermal. It was too expensive. Right. So that's the kind of project that they might be able to fund through the IRA. I can't keep them straight. To me, the IRA is the Irish Republican Army or something.
I think it's a retirement plan.
Oh, yeah, it's also a retirement plan, right. It's that, too, the IRA, right. At any rate, it would be good for you to let Crookston know that they might be able to get some funding, but it doesn't fund the total cost. And it was super expensive, as I recall, to do that. $40 million, I don't remember now the number.
Certainly, Madam Chair, and I think each project pencils differently. And so what the tax credits do is somewhat buy down the total cost of transition, but then in conjunction with the loans help to spread that cost out over time.
There you go. Okay. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. Just one final question. Very interesting report, by the way. Thank you so much. On the FFIS, the Federal Funds Infrastructure Services, I know I've been on that website before, but I thought I needed a password. Is it, can legislators get to this, or how do we get to this?
Madam Chair and Senator, that's a great question. I'm not sure the restrictions on our subscription, but I will look into that and get back to you offline.
Thank you so much.
Great. Any other questions? All right. Well, we hope we'll be seeing a lot of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then our final presentation today is the Office of State Auditor. Glad you could come and join us. We had hoped to see you earlier, and I know we rescheduled.
Thank you.
And glad you're here today. About the infrastructure stress transparency tool.
We'll set our stuff up and then. Okay. And I can hand it across. Okay. Oh, great.
And welcome, State Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. Leader Housley, members of the committee, so happy to be here today. Oh, what did I just do? Okay, there we go. I'm putting up the handout that we have to start here so that if you want to play along at home, you can go right to the QR code, and that's for those of you watching online. You can also join in the fun. I'm also joined by senior researcher John Jernberg, who will be walking through the specifics of the tool today. So basically, we're here today to talk about water infrastructure, and but more specifically to visualize it. The Minnesota Infrastructure Stress Transparency Tool provides maps, and it also reports on size, location, age, finances, a number of metrics about our district water and sewer systems. And so this tool, the idea is to bring the data sets together and to help visualize them. The project grew out of the University of Minnesota's 2015 Smart Cities and Infrastructure Convergence Colloquium. I don't use the word colloquium enough in my life. The Office of the State Auditor was part of a serendipity grant that came out of that. Now, this data isn't just ours, of course. It's a collaboration between USpatial at the University of Minnesota and infrastructure data experts from agencies including the Department of Health, Pollution Control, Public Facilities Authority, Infrastructure Alliance, used to be Minnesota 250. In fact, we do have people here with us today from those groups. In fact, Len Kinney, who's the director of USpatial, research and computing at the University of Minnesota. Chad Kolstad is also here. He's a supervisor for drinking water protection infrastructure, the infrastructure unit at the Minnesota Department of Health, and Bill Dunn, the Clean Water Revolving Fund Coordinator, is here. So if you have some deep questions about the data, they're available for us. But let's get right to the fun of it and get into the tool. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to, again, OSA Senior Researcher John Jernberg.
And welcome, Mr. Jernberg.
Thank you, Madam. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Pappas, and honorable members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to show you something we're pretty proud of. And this kind of, a lot of our agencies have silos of data, and they're not brought together. And what this tool does is it brings those silos together, and it not only allows us to show them visually, the data visually, but also gives a dashboard for each entity that is represented within our data. So what I'm going to start out with is the data. Let's see here. I'm sorry.
Yes, Auditor Blaha.
Senator Pappas, we were debating about which of your legislative districts to use. And so we have been digging into all of them and looking at which ones have the most interesting data visualizations. So if you have specific questions, we can hook you up.
Okay. As we look at this dashboard, there's five different tabs. And under each tab, you can select different things. And when we look at maps, we look at four different types of maps, and it's related to collection and treatment, the financial aspects under sewer enterprise and water enterprise, and then asset management. And for each map, and right now we're looking at the predominant collection sewer system age. And when you select a map, next to that selection, you'll see a legend. And in this case, circles represent cities, diamonds represent special districts, and the colors represent the age, predominant age of the sewer collection system. And so in this case, green is less than 30, yellow is between 30 and 50 years old, and red is over 50 years old. And the size of the dot or the diamond represents how many miles of sewer systems in the city or special district. And we also have a shading that will tell you, is it closer to 100% that's red, or, you know, 67, 50%. So it also provides that type of information. To look at a specific entity, you can either click on a circle or a diamond, or you can use the search box to enter in a name of a city or a special district. To zoom in on an area, you can use the plus or minus to zoom in, and or you can use your scroll to move in that way. The other thing that the tool has is the ability to select geographic boundaries that we look at. And we have counties, basins, watersheds, and House and Senate districts. So if we look at a Senate boundary, and and then we go to filters, and we have various filters. We have demographic filters, such as population, household, median household income, so you can select things that way. But I'm going to look at geography filters, and we can just look at a Senate district. And so what I'm going to take a look at is Senate District 19, and there you go, sir. Senator.
Thank you.
So it's just going to highlight that the entities in that district, because those may be of your most concern. And if we want to look at the data for
Madam Chair.
Senator Friend.
Thank you. I'm cheering for Senator Jasinski as much as anybody, but I think we have actually Senate District 18 on here now that the numbers have changed, which, wouldn't you know it, I represent, which I think is just super. I just didn't want to have any back and forth between me and Senator Jasinski so we can bring bipartisan support to this outstanding district and the infrastructure in it, unless you want to put 19 up there, which
that's
is
never happened
east.
Back and forth. So if you could put side by side, then we could have a little competition.
Members, I apologize. This year, my district changed from 19 to 18. Uh-huh. And so I think what's on the screen here is District 18, which is the old 19, which is Mankato, North Mankato, St. Peter, and all of rural Nicollet County.
So not Faribault.
We do
which
have
is great, I think, if you think
so. So, Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. And good point. We do have a new version of this coming out this week. And I'm guessing that overlay might be one of those things that will also be in there. All right. Well, again, we're focusing on.
Okay.
So, if I click on a dot here, and I'm not sure which city this is going to be. So this is Cortland. And so this is the dashboard for the city of Cortland. And first we have the demographic information, population, household, medium household income. And then as we go to the next thing, which is collection sewer system by age category, in this case, 100% of the system is less than 30 years old. And we can scroll down, and the wastewater treatment facility in this case is operated by the city of New Ulm. And wastewater charges, residents are typically charged $35 per 5,000 gallons per month used. And then this is who pays the maintenance, operating maintenance costs by connection type. So in this case, 89% is paid by residential users and 10% by non-residential users. We then get into financial information. It doesn't operate its own sewer system, so there are not financial numbers there. It has no clean water projects on the priority project list, clean water project priority list. Then this is the amount of drinking water usage and storage within the city. And I'm not gonna go into the details of what this represents, but if you have a question, for each item within the dashboard, there's a little I, and oops, can't get to that. There we go. So if you select the I, I don't know why that's doing that.
I did reduce this way down.
Oh, it was reduced. but it will show you information about what that represents. So in this case, we have drinking water assets, the number of wells are two, treatment plants one, storage is one, it's elevated. So it provides that type of information. This would provide water enterprise fund income information. So if things are operating, if the amount of revenues coming in pays for the service, it's going to be above the red. If it's below, it means it's operating in the red. And we have net income, operating income excluding depreciation. And depreciation often for these big, for systems like this, the depreciation, especially on a newer, I believe in the city was 100%, was less than 30 years old, the depreciation costs are going to be very high, and so that affects the operating income and the net income.
Mr. Jernberg, where do you get this information? This is the questions we ask when we're on bonding tours.
So the financial information comes from the Office of the State Auditor, and the office issues every year reports that are called Minnesota City Finances 2022, for example. And if you go to the enterprise section of that report, you can find this information there. We also have it available for download.
So these cities are required to provide this information to the office?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Chairman Pappas, that is correct. Okay. They are required to report to us.
Okay.
Another.
Just a minute before you continue. Center Friends has another correction about the district numbers.
First of all, thank you, Senator Pappas, and thanks, members. This is incredible, and I just wanted to point out to the members that we do have an Eagle Lake water bonding project, and since I know you got a green dot, if you click on that, then I'll at least be able to say that I brought the Eagle Lake Water Project to the attention of the committee as we looked at the state auditor's transparency site. It's all the way to the east, right up against Senator Draheim's district.
Right.
No, no. See where it says Mankato?
Oh, east.
Down, straight down. Right
there.
Click that.
That's going to show up in our data, is it?
So what's interesting about something that we're proud of about this is we can compare two cities in your district side by side, and as you scroll down, you're looking at the same information side by side. And so you can see, you know, the residents are typically charged this amount, and you can see the age of the systems, things like that. So it's side by side. And again, in this case, Eagle Lake does have a sewer enterprise fund, so the financial information is there, but Cortland does not, so there's no financial information. If a city has failed to report to our office, again, there would not be data for that given year. So we can go down side by side and see
all of that information.
Mr. Jernberg, what's a sewer enterprise fund?
A sewer enterprise fund, Madam Chairman, is a proprietary type of accounting, much like the private sector, where it shows, revenues or fees that are paid into the city for the service. Sorry, my lips are drying up here a little bit. So enterprise fund accounting is very much like private sector accounting. We have operating revenues, operating expenses, non-operating revenues, non-operating expenses, and you come up with a net income. And this allows us to see if the fees that are charged by the city or the special district are covering the costs of providing the service. And we want to see that above, at least in the positive zone.
So it's not increasing their reserve for potential replacement, it's just making sure that they have the operating dollars they need for the current sewer system.
Chairman Pappas, they, part of the operating expense is depreciation. Mm-hmm. And depreciation is, it's kind of a paper expense. It is what should be set aside mm-hmm. for future replacement. That doesn't mean that is necessarily being set aside, but mm-hmm. that is in their books what should be set aside for replacement costs in however many years the depreciation schedule is on.
Senator Jasinski. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Just going back to my mayor days, so the easiest way I understood it was it's not like non-general funds. So usually you have a general fund for your city to operate. This is enterprise funds. We're actually collecting revenues and paying expenses. So the water sewer is a very typical one of that. But it took me a while to figure that out.
I see. It's a separate fund.
Like revenue bonds. It's revenue funds. So it's anything that you're collecting a fee on and you're paying back outside the general fund.
Outside the general fund. Got it. Right. Senator Paugh.
So I just want to say this is an incredible tool. I should have spent some time playing with it after this. But I'm wondering if we can pull a report off of this site where, let's say, I'm particularly interested in the cities or counties that have infrastructure that's over 50 years old. Can I pull a report that lists all of that versus going through each one and looking at the red dots?
Thank you, Senator Fah. We don't currently have the ability to download that, but as part of the filters, we have financial filters. And so we could look at number of years with positive net income. And so if we just selected zero, we would only get those cities that have that. So there's ways to look at that in the larger context. What I would say is that is something that we would like to include in the future, and it is also, the information is also available per data request from either our office or Department of Health or Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And again, the Office of the State Auditor is the expertise on the financial aspect of it. A lot of the things on the project priority lists and things like that are Department of Health. And so we have like Chad Colander and Bill Dunn from Department of Health and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency who are the experts in those areas. But that it's a great question and it's something that we would like to incorporate. Every little piece costs money, and we've had, it was originally funded through the Serendipity Grant, and then a Bush Foundation grant, and then the Office of the State Auditor funded the next upgrade, and the upgrade that's occurring right now is from the through the Department of Health and their lead service lines. So there's going to be a new map that's showing all of the lead service lines in the state of Minnesota.
and that's part of, it's not going to be mapped on this map. It's a, that's a, that will be a separate piece, but it will also, it's also helping fund the upgrade of both updating the data and kind of a new look to it, which will be coming out, that part will be coming out later this week.
Chair Pappas?
Ms. Blaha.
Senator Faw, and we welcome those asks. The kind of data that you're looking for really helps us form how we want to present the data going forward. So we'd be happy to be your first call for help on this data. John will hook you up.
Thank you.
Senator Pa.
As we did our bonding tours, there were so many communities, counties, cities that we spoke with that often talked about their water and sewer needs, and they didn't know how they compare with others. I wonder how many, if I'm sure some of the bigger cities may be aware of this tool. There's a lot of smaller towns, counties that that do not know of this tool. And I think this would be super helpful for them because some of them were paying really high sewer charges and they thought that was normal. And then some of them were paying very low and they thought that was really high. We're like, no, compared to others, you're not that high. So this is a great tool for our entire state to use in a lot of information that they can pull from here. Thank you so much for introducing this.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just also wanted to add, really, what a great tool this is. And it kind of makes me think you were channeling our chair, who asked a number of these questions at every water project utility that we looked at. And my question is, as a member of this committee, looking at all of those projects, and wouldn't it be interesting to have a little booklet of all of the projects? I mean, just a little snapshot of every project that was on the bonding tour that had these particular requests.
Oh, not every project.
No, not all
364.
Just the water ones, the utility ones where we have this information.
They submitted MMB forms to last summer in June, so I think that information is available. I don't know if MMB can pull a report on just the water and sewer projects.
So,
but that's it is available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Yeah. So I just also noted how I thought the one metric was really important too, which was as you were looking at those utility fees, you looked at what percent of the median income of that is for the community, because every community is so very different. But I think it would be great to get a list. Well, maybe someone has an intern who can do that and pull a sheet for each one of the water projects that we looked at, and it would be so interesting to compare that percent of median income that was being paid. So anyway, just very great tool. Thank you.
I think those questions are not on the MMB form, so maybe, but they're on her side.
It sounds like I'm being invited to go on a trip.
Yes.
But I think that the idea of how do we make this available or make sure we're training somebody on your team so that when they go out, they have this available and they can pop it out. Mm-hmm. That might be. We also have other comparison tools on our site where we compare budgeting and things like that. And I think maybe just the idea of training someone on the team so that they're ready to use them.
Nelson.
Just one more question to follow up on that, though. Is this a printable thing? So literally, if we wanted to compare the different projects that we've seen on the bonding tour regarding the services that you've put here, is this how would we compare those? Or if we wanted to rank those in order of percent, a median income or something, how would we take that data? Let's say we had 40 of these projects. How would we be able to analyze, using the great data that you have, these 40 projects? I'm not clear if there's a printable page or if you can get the data in a spreadsheet. I'm just not sure what that would look like.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. Senator Nelson, I think that it's not in the form. I love what you're thinking of. And also, but I think the idea, we could certainly talk about, if you gave us parameters of what you're looking for, how can we get that in a form that's usable for you? And how can we pull that? And we could pull you something, I think. We can make a pull like that. And I also hear, I know that Len Kania is here too, who, by the way, the discussions we were having about the new data dashboards that we are building for our office, and again, thanks for that support. For that, he is also working on those projects for us too. So I just basically say, Len can do it. We'll find a way. So let us know what you're looking for. We'll see.
Senator Nelson, the staff, when we're visiting projects, also sends them a template of the information we'd like to see presented. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you'll see a community, a town will give a presentation and we'll go, that was great. We don't have any questions. You've answered it all for us. And other times it's like pulling teeth to kind of get information because they haven't thought about their water and sewer fees, and you know, it's kind of a complicated formula, and we would like it in a more, you know, kind of simple, just average, give us your average fee for a household of four, you know, how much water do you use and how much do you charge? And that's what we're really kind of looking for, so we can do that internal kind of comparisons.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator
the
Nelson.
One thing that I didn't get in that I thought was so important here is that it showed percent of median income, because yeah, that's so different on how those fees impact different economic areas that are looking at yeah. this. So I just thought that particular piece would be incredibly mm-hmm. helpful as we try to weigh out all of those pieces.
Absolutely, and that is also one of the questions we do ask them with the template. And, you know, whether they provide it or not is another question that we have to ask again. On this side of the table, Senator Jasinski.
So I know we're getting late. I just want one last thing. So, again, I want to thank you for this. Is a great tool. And I've actually been playing around the website as well. The reports and data analysts actually shows every city's budget, the general fund, how they compare to other cities as well. So that's another great feature under the reports and data analysts. Auditor Blah, so one question on the sewer and operating maintenance cost paid. There's a circle there. If you can click on one of those, there's a number inside the circle. What is that number?
Do you understand the question?
I'm trying to find it out, but I can't. So
if we could,
you can scroll down. If you scroll down, right, that blue circle. So what's the dollar amount in the middle there? The one is 71,000, the other side. What's that dollar amount in the middle represent?
Chair Pappas, Senator Jasinski, can I turn this over?
Yeah.
To,
yeah.
Director.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Jernberg.
Mr. Jernberg, yes.
Yes. Chairperson Pappas, Senator, that is the total operating and maintenance costs paid per year. If you look at, why does that do that?
Here, let me try something.
I think that's probably what it was. It was inside the blue circle there, yeah.
Is it right here in your chat? Yeah.
It's a little jerky.
Did that help?
Yeah, let's see. So what we see here is, well, actually, is Chad still here? Chad?
Wastewater.
Oh, that's wastewater. So it's the income from all sources used to pay this one's the 2014 annual cost of wastewater collection and treatment. And so that's what that number represents in this.
So that was the 77,000 up in the middle of the circle?
Yeah.
So those are not real time. That sounds like an awful big delay from 2014. That's 10 years old data. And if, you know, I like the data, but if it's 10 years old, that maybe that's not telling us an accurate picture.
Chairman Pappas and Senator, this should all be updated again. Hopefully this week we'll have the updated numbers. It's been a while since this has been updated, this particular feature.
So we're mm-hmm. you just clicked on there must be footnotes of that dollar amount. So how did you get to that point so you can see how old the data is? Again, if it's 10-year-old data, I don't know if it's doing us great good, but if it's if it's going to be updated, then it will be. And is there, I'm assuming there's probably one fiscal year delay to accumulate all the data and things like that. So at some point, will we be 1 or 2 year delay versus a 10 year delay? Is that what we're hoping?
I forget to speak to that.
Chair Blaha. I'm sorry, Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Pappas, Senator Jasinski. This is one of the things that we have done in my term is that we have decided to include these regular updates in our basic basic operating costs, so that we should have that. There has been delays throughout the project, but now we are back on to regular updates for that. Now, again, it may be more than one fiscal year, though. Too unfortunately, this data can lag a couple of years, partly for it's got to get through the audit, then get into the entity, and then get back to us. But no, that is a change that we've made, that it will be regularly updated.
So members, my computer whiz to the left here just said there is a way to pull a summary report from this tool based on age of system, and she found there are 156 systems that are over 50 years old. And that's certainly what we saw, a lot of those systems, right? All right, thank you very much. If there's no other questions, this has just been a great committee hearing and a great presentation to wrap up with, and we appreciate all your work, and we'll look forward to using the tool.
Thank you, Senator and committee. We will take your advice also on getting the word out and continuing to publicize this tool. Thank you.
Great, thank you. All right, committee is adjourned.